Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
A tantalizing new clue in the disappearance of flying ace Amelia Earhart 75 years ago. An unlikely detective has taken up her case, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Here's ABC's Dan Harris.
She is one of the most iconic women of the last century. She is one of the most powerful women of this century. And today, Hillary Clinton said she will try to help solve the mystery of what happened to Amelia Earhart with a new search based on a tantalizing clue in this grainy old picture.
There's Miss Earhart in flying talks.
Amelia Earhart disappeared while trying to become the first woman in history to fly around the world. But she vanished over the South Pacific.
Video spurs the Earharts.
That was 1937. Fast forward 23 years, a 13-year-old Hillary Clinton writes a letter to NASA asking to be an astronaut. They tell her, no girls allowed.
NASA may have said I couldn't go into space, but nobody was there to tell Amelia Earhart she couldn't do what she chose to do.
Today, as Secretary of State, Clinton publicly endorsed a renewed search for Earhart based on a new clue in this old picture taken off Gardner Island, a wisp of land in the South Pacific. Look at what experts spotted. That blurry bit on the left there, could that possibly be the landing gear of Earhart's Lockheed Electra? This summer, a search party, including the underwater explorer who helped find the Titanic, will go diving for answers. And if they succeed, they will have solved a 75-year-old mystery and forever linked an American heroine and the girl she inspired.
Forensic image processing and analyzation is one of the most crucial areas of expertise in the entire Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan disappearance case. Used by multiple hypotheses in the case, it's become a combination of art and science that has been responsible for much of the advancement in the investigation. Tonight, Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart podcast continues with a project guest that has been highly involved both in that field and in this case. Tonight we discuss both the science and the process of forensic image processing via Zoom with Jeff Glickman of FOTEC. Jeff gives us his thoughts on his work on the castaway hypothesis, the anomaly in the now famous Bevington image, and how he arrived at his declaration on that image and why he believes that the Amelia Earhart case continues to capture and enthrall the entire world. I'd like to welcome Jeff Glickman to tonight's show. Jeff's personal involvement and his professional credentials make him a great guest to weigh in on this case. He's a member of the state of Washington's Forensic Investigators Council, and he's a board-certified forensic examiner. He also oversees FOTEC, an internationally recognized forensic image processing laboratory, which uses state-of-the-art digital technology to examine, restore, and recover photographic images. Jeff, this is a pleasure. Welcome to Chasing Earhart, sir.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Jeff, let's get housekeeping out of the way before we dive in. Can you tell us a little about your education and your professional background?
Oh, sure. My background is as a computer scientist. I was trained at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I have a strong background there academically in image processing and pattern recognition. And got into the forensic side of things, as many people do, as a related activity to their primary area of academia. Forensics, you know, as you probably know, means simply to argue. And there's about 300 different fields in this field of forensics, which means if there's an area of science or a specialty, there's a forensic scientist related to that field.
Any early recollections or first memories of Amelia Earhart that you can share with us?
I'm sure I heard about it as a child at some point, but really wasn't in the forefront of my mind until the 1990s.
I think it's important to discuss what you do when it comes to forensic image analyzation and processing before we get into some specifics. Can you give us an overview?
Sure. It varies pretty widely depending upon what the particular case or subject material is. The essentials of it have to do with taking some kind of imagery, whether it's from a regular camera, film camera, or a digital camera, or a surveillance camera, some of which might be in the form of moving images. Now, I'm a little careful to say that because moving images are really just sequences of still images, though how they are taken, stored, and managed can vary significantly depending upon whether they're analog or what we would call film, or whether they're of digital origin. The kind of processing really depends upon the case. It's very hard to say. You have to be very specific about what kind of case, and then we can dive into what kind of processing might be amenable to that specific problem.
All right, fair enough. Let's dive into the case that we're here to discuss then tonight, and that's the Amelia Earhart investigation. I know there's been some recent news that is newly breaking, but for this discussion, we'll center on the original central focus, which is known as the Bevington object, and the subsequent photo of said object. My first question is regarding age. When you're looking at a photo that's as old as this one, is your process different in analyzing, or is it business as usual?
Both, actually. So the nature of older film is you have to deal with something called film grain. So this is the molecular composition of the photo emulsion. The older the film grain, or older the film, usually the grainier it is, because it has larger grain size. And even the shape of the grain changes. So how you choose to do processing may vary because of that. In particular, some of the processing you may choose to use may interact in a positive way or a negative way with the source media. Notably, in digital photography, the pixels are square. But then subsequent processing and storage of that digital imagery may also affect the way that you process them. So I'll give you a couple examples. In film grain, the grain is laid out in irregular patterns on the photo emulsion layer. So you don't really know if you, let's say, drew a vertical column or a horizontal row, whether or not you were going to intersect a grain and what percentage of a grain you might intersect, assuming you were looking at a sufficiently resolute image. Whereas you compare that to digital photography, and everything's rectilinear, so you're going to find all those pixels will align. In the case of digital imagery, and particularly if its images have been stored in a compressed form, like a JPEG image, you're going to run into blocks of pixels, sometimes 8x8, sometimes other sizes, 32x32, that are going to behave differently than adjacent blocks. And this is because of the way that JPEG images are stored. So the choice of processing is very sensitive, highly sensitive, in fact, to the original source media. It's very important that you be able to trace backwards and find that origin of the materials so that you're able to process with as little, essentially, artifact as possible. So that means when you're processing, there's the potential to introduce false information, and you want to hold that to a minimum, control for it, and certainly understand the way in which you're affecting the subsequent imagery.
I know that some cases must be more difficult than others to work on, but typically, how long would it take for you to process a case and see definitive results that can be delivered to your client?
There's no typical answer to that. I've had cases where we've been able to do, you know, very quick and accurate work within, say, 24 to 48 hours. Which is about as fast as you can go. Of course, in forensics, the report is actually more important than the actual processing. So, but then, frankly, I've had other cases where a decade has gone by, where in order to be able to get the processing accomplished, sometimes in part because the technology just wasn't there at the time that we started the case.
And that's a good segue into the Amelia Earhart Fred Newton investigation. Can you tell me how you got introduced to this case originally and how your work with Tiger and the Castaway Hypothesis began?
Sure. Yeah, happy to do that. I think the year was about 1995, and I think I saw Rick on a television show or a newscast or something of the sort, and he was describing some issues that they were having at the project, including interpretation of imagery. I thought, well, this is something I could probably lend some expertise to. So I picked up the phone and I called him and I said, look, this is a field I'm expert in and perhaps I can help you. He took me up on the offer and I've worked with him now for, I guess, 22 years.
Everyone comes to this case for a vast amount of reasons, but what was it that initially piqued your curiosity and drew you to the case? Was it simply the idea that you could help, or were there other reasons?
Well, probably both, but you know, it's just a good thing to give something back. So if there's opportunities to do work on a pro bono basis, you know, I try and do that from time to time.
And that brings us to the Bevington object and the accompanying photo. How did you get introduced to that image and what were your initial thoughts on it?
Yeah, that's a funny story. So when I met Rick initially, he had sent me a bunch of negatives for images. So I don't know what year it was, but it was probably somewhere around 1998 or 2000 or so in that time frame. And we were looking for something at the time. I think we were looking for the, it was the water collection device, which had been reported anecdotally, and which I did eventually end up finding in the imagery. So it was on the coastline of Nicaragua. So I had this collection of negatives, which just basically went into cold storage. And about a decade later, Rick said, hey, we're going back to the island. Do you mind just taking a look at some of the historical imagery? Now, this particular image was interesting in that really you could see a large horizon of the island, plus also the SS Norwich City, which was an old ship. Just by happenstance, Rick had focused in or essentially cropped a digital copy of the image, which he kept there back at Tiger headquarters. To focus in on the SS Norwich City, which really was the only thing of interest in the image. Now, I had the original uncropped negative here. And so when I started researching for the 2010-ish trip that they were going to take out there, I just reviewed all the imagery, and I ran across an anomaly in the in this particular image. Just didn't make sense, didn't make visual sense. Something cognitively for me said this is not a normal sort of image defect. It's very, very small on the negative. And, you know, there's so many defects that you have in analog photography due to processing, due to film staining, any number of sources that it's easy to overlook something like this. So starting in 2010, I started looking at this image for the better part of a year. And so years worth of analysis and processing came to the conclusion that it was actually something on the reef, and that my interpretation of it at the end of a year's period was that it was part of a landing gear assembly with part of a tire attached to the landing gear assembly. So I reported that to Rick, and then Rick, of course, took that to some other folks. We always do things with confirmation. You don't ever want to have the opinion of a single analyst.
We now know what the anomaly in the image was determined to be. After examining the image for the better part of a year, how did you come to determining that this was a landing gear that you were looking at?
Well, you first try and rule out possibilities. So you say, all right, what kind of defect could this possibly be on the film, just as an example? Defects on film tend to have certain specific patterns to them. One thing they don't tend to do is they don't tend to create the appearance of shadows, because if there's an appearance of a shadow, then that's suggestive of something originating from the imagery instead of the coming from the film surface. So you look for contradictions, basically, in information, often when they're adjacent on the image. And then you keep working up the sort of abstract concept hierarchy from there. So when you eliminate the possibility of it being something related to the film or the film processing, then you start saying, okay, it's something that it actually took an image of. Now, what are all the potential possibilities? What can we include or what can we exclude? And eventually that took me toward examining drawings of the engineering drawings of the Lockheed, of the airframe. We went down the path of looking at the landing gear assembly, the circular portion being related, of course, to the tire, as we now know. So that's kind of generally the process. And in so doing, Rick remembered that there was some historical imagery of one of Earhart's crash landings. I think it, not sure the location, quite frankly, at this point, compared the failure of the landing gear assembly in that crash to the object that was on the reef. And there was some remarkable similarities between the two, and probably because of the kind of stress that was put onto the landing gear assembly. We do know from the engineering work that was done on the airplane that the lateral stress load that could be put on the landing gear was quite small. And when there was a lateral stress, it would cause that landing gear to snap off, opposed to the the forward and backward stress. So just things started adding up. And once you have that body of evidence, you have to start applying things like Occam's razor, which is,
right,
in simple terms, is there a simpler explanation for this? And there isn't.
The process you're describing is one that I'm personally a fan of, because you're reverse engineering this hypothesis regarding the image, and that you're trying to rule every other possibility out until all that's left is what you're left with here, which is your professional determination. Is that process exciting for you as you get closer and closer to it being what you're thinking it might be, or do you have to remain objective even to the very end?
So for objective analysis, excitement is a hazard. That's not something you really want to do. You want to separate the emotions from actually doing the analysis, and make sure you stay on the straight and narrow.
Once your determination was made and was brought to other analysts to confirm, was it then collectively agreed upon by them that your original professional opinion was correct?
Right. So I think probably best if you talk to Rick about that. I had no involvement with that portion of it, which is all for the better. I mean, again, you want to keep these silos of information separate, make sure the analysts don't contaminate each other's opinions.
Jeff, you've been at this for a while, and I wonder if you can tell me what it is about this case in particular that continues to attract so much attention, and why the work continues to intrigue you.
It's a great question. It's certainly one that would be personal opinion, so I'm going to sidestep here from professional information about what I do for the project to personal opinion. I think there's a lot of reasons. I don't think it's any one single thing. I heard some excellent comments from I think one of the people from the Smithsonian once at a conference. And I think in part it's about the way that we identify with these individuals, the notion of getting lost at sea, sort of the horror of that, and how deeply in our cores as individuals we fear something like that happening. And so I think that sort of reaches into something that's very personal for everybody, and deeply anthropological. My personal opinion is it's closely related to that. So much like the human need for survival, it may be tightly coupled with survival instincts. I've probably done half a dozen or dozen image processing projects for the group, but the Bevington one certainly is the standout.
That's all the time we have with you. I know you're quite busy right now. Thanks for joining me and for giving us your insight. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart Podcast, part of our Castaway retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, Visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart Project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.